We want these investigations to be dealt with as quickly as possible. We want those responsible to be brought to justice.
Considering the foregoing, many are now wondering if there are any prospects for justice in this case, particularly considering the fact that British troops walked away scot-free after committing horrendous crimes in Kenya and elsewhere in the world. So, are the prospects quite slim?
I think the prospects are still quite slim. And again, it depends on what you define as justice. Right now, there is lots of talk of getting the soldiers extradited to Kenya to stand trial here. But the fact that you're seeing the names of the soldiers are still being kept secret, we still don't know who they are, the people who are to be extradited, means that it's quite questionable whether there is a lot of will to pursue this in a serious way. The other thing to think about is that given the time lag that we've had, more than 10 years, is the evidence still there to hold them guilty and to hold them accountable for this? So I think there's quite a lot of questions as to whether we can really secure a guilty verdict. And even if we were to get a guilty verdict, what would be the punishment? What would be a requisite punishment? Would they be, for example, jailed in Kenya, in Kenyan prisons? Or would we have a situation where they are sentenced here and then sent to a prison in the UK?
Now, Kenyan members of parliament have threatened to reject a renewed military agreement signed recently between the country and Britain unless suspects in the killing of Agnes Wanjiru are extradited and prosecuted according to Kenyan laws.
So until we have concrete evidence to suggest that the Kenya government is looking into this matter and the culprit actually being brought back to Kenya to face our criminal justice system, then there's a time now we can probably append our signatures.
Now, Mr. Gathara speaks here about this military deal now that members of parliament in Kenya have threatened to shoot it down.
Well, I think it's a good question. I mean, why should we be giving British soldiers space to come in and do their military exercises here? Why don't they do them back at home? You know, and also, as you mentioned, given the fact that we have these sorts of conflicts between locals and the troops, we know, like, for example, there was a big issue about unexploded munitions being left lying around and people stepping on them or handling them and ending up getting injured. You know, and there was a court case and some compensation that was ordered paid. But it is still an issue. You know, why should we be allowing it? This is 60 years after independence. What are these deals about? And it's really important to remember that these are not agreements that the ordinary citizens are involved in. You know, they are really government-to-government ones. They take very little account of whether or not the local population wants this this military people here, you know. So I think for me it's quite problematic. I think I see no reason and no justification for continuing to host foreign military people on our soil, especially when our people are having to pay such a high price for it.
Kenya's Defense Cabinet Secretary has acknowledged that justice has been delayed for the woman murdered by British troops, but has promised to ensure justice is served.
Indeed, justice has been delayed for Agnes Wanjiru and her young child, but it must not be denied. We must do everything to ensure, invoking the powers provided under the Defense Cooperation Agreement, to ensure that that is done.
The crimes committed by British troops in Kenya have gone unpunished, contrary to the agreement between the two countries. Some people believe this level of impunity by the British military is historical.
Historically, there has been a sense of impunity. I mean, if you go back 60 years to the Mau Mau conflict in the 1950s, We have till today people who are still alive who committed terrible atrocities against the local population. You know, people who tortured people in the concentration camps that were set up, who ran these concentration camps, people who murdered, you know, who were there. They are old now, but there has been absolutely no attempt to hold them to account for this. And we know that the British actually took out in 1963, just prior to independence, they, stole a huge cache of documents, not just from Kenya, but from their colonies around the world, you know, in an attempt to actually hide the fact that these atrocities happened.
This is why Nuruddin Haji, Kenya's director of public prosecutions, says the government would request extradition of troops involved in the murder to face charges in Kenya.
It's going on well. I think you saw on Friday, the DCI met with the British officials, and we have agreed on the best way to move. The court had, in the inquest, indicated that we proceed with the case, and after compilation by the DCI, we will be ready to proceed accordingly.
We asked Mr. Gadara to give us his final thoughts on what it will take to solve the Agnes Wanjiru murder file.
Well, there's a number of things I think are required to be done. The first is there has to be a serious, thorough, unfettered investigation of what happened in the case of Agnes Wanjiru, and a full-bodied prosecution here in Kenya, you know, of the soldiers. I think we need to get away from the impression that's created right now of this sort of anonymous soldiers. They need to be named, we need to know who they are, and we need to see that using the phrase that they like using, that no stone is left unturned in pushing for accountability for it. But beyond that, I think there needs to be serious discussions about why it is we are having soldiers from the British still active here in Kenya, why are they doing trainings here, and what are the safeguards, any, for local people, so that we don't see this happen again.
Well, thanks, Mr. Gadara, Kenyan writer and cartoonist. Unfortunately, our time is up for today. Here at Africa Today, we shall continue following up the case of Agnes Wanjiru as the family seeks prosecution of British troops involved in this gruesome murder. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on how most of Africa's stolen art is still stashed in Western countries, despite exaggerated reports of the return of some of the looted artifacts. Stay with us.
Stolen African art stashed in Western museums.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The French government has returned some 26 artworks it looted from Benin. Now, this is just a fraction of thousands of items stolen by France in the 19th century from Benin, including from its palaces of Abomey, now a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Some of these artifacts were stolen by colonial administrators, troops or doctors, and passed down to descendants. Many of these looted artifacts are still in private collections, but hundreds of thousands are kept in museums across Europe and North America.
Speaking in Paris during the signing of an agreement to bring back the stolen art, Benin's president said the return of the 26 pieces is just a first step.
We hope that the restitution of these 26 works of art is just a first step in the ambitious process of restituting heritage pieces.
Now for more on the struggle for return of all looted African artifacts stashed in European and North American museums, my colleague contacted Joseph Ochieno, a writer and African affairs analyst. Now we first asked Mr. Ochieno his take on why Western countries are suddenly returning some of the cultural heritage items they looted in Africa.
This is a very important question, and I think it's the case that credit to media agencies like yourselves, credit to the campaigns by various African communities, organizations, and indeed a few progressive Western academic institutions, that following slavery and beyond slavery, it's time that now Africa should be able to have what belongs to it. The cultural artifacts were, like, if you like, amongst those things that very much determined the realities and the backbone of our civilizations. And they were looted and stolen. And of course, these are prized items that directly relate and link with the African communities. But beyond that, I think it is also the case that as the world moves on, a much more younger generation of Western citizenry and indeed scholars becoming part of the campaign for fairness and global justice. And that must therefore really include questions of artifacts or whatever other material items will have been looted from either Africa or any of the rest of the other worlds that were by and large colonized by Western powers.
According to some estimates, the Quai Branly Museum in Paris alone holds some 70,000 African objects, yet Mehran handed over only 26 artifacts to Benin amid a media circus. A curator from a museum in Benin speaks before the return of the looted artifacts in this Paris museum.
These art pieces are of essential importance for Benin. It has been more than a century that these pieces have been removed from their historical context. These artifacts returning to the country today is just historical for the people of Benin.
Now, considering the high number of looted African artifacts being held in Western museums, is this highly publicized return of just a few of the looted items meant to hoodwink the public?
It was purely that, hoodwink, and I think it's scandalous, isn't it? Because up to 90% or thereabouts of precious African artifacts are held in either Western museum or libraries. So I think this is one of the things that needs to be done, and that is that African governments, African advocacy group, and indeed global organizations, including news media like Press TV, as we talk today, should double their efforts in making sure that these loots are actually returned not only to Africa, but respective African communities. This is direct theft that took place hundreds of years ago, but it's the direct theft that now that has been established that who stole and where these items should be returned to the owners.
The president of Benin, Patrice Talon, made it clear that the handover was the first step in a large-scale restitution process. We asked Mr. Ochieno if there is any legal or political mechanism to compel European colonial powers to return all the artifacts they stole from Africa.
I think there would be a very important legal case. This must be a really important legal basis on which, as I said, the principal property and ownership, that if these are items that were taken from Africans by force and against the wills of many Africans, in many cases, brutalizing and killing the owners of these items, there's no reason why a legal test case is not put in place, number one. But number two, the Africans continue to advocate for reparations, including for and around slavery. I would be one of those people who would join part of that campaign and make sure that this is actually enhanced. That is both legally and indeed politically. But beyond that, I think African governments today should have the ability and the capacity to demand that these items are actually returned, and so are African academic institutions. So those are political pressures. But beyond that, I think African civil society organizations, and indeed possibly young African academicians, can actually opt to boycott some of the institutions that hold these items. That is to put pressure. Finally, I think global agencies that like the United Nations should surely be the space where these conversations should be able to take place, and to compel Western governments to return what really is not theirs and what is really, really African.
26 works of art stolen by France returned to Benin on the 10th of November. This was a landmark in the long fight by African countries to recover looted artifacts. A member of one of Benin's royal families believes the return is important for young people in the country.
I think the youth should take a keen interest in the museum that will be built. Because I think the youth is a bit lost in terms of tradition.
Are the masses in Africa, especially the youth, aware of the continent's artifacts looted by Western countries during the colonial period?
Part of the challenge is that many Africans possibly don't even know the fact that this kind of act does exist. Many of the African governments continue today, in many cases, to work and relate with many of these Western organizations, and so therefore calm down their citizens. But beyond that, going forward, as I say, you know, these are opportunities for tourism. These are opportunities for reclaiming our civilization. And thanks to programs like yourself, these matters and subjects must be on the national table. But guess what? While I know this through my research, campaigns and advocacy, I'm not quite sure how many nation states televisions had these subjects that hit the headlines. Think about South Africa, the possibly the most established in terms of academia and universities and institutions of learning and research. In South Africa, I doubt. In Egypt, I doubt. In big Nigeria, I doubt. In Kenya, I doubt. So that tells you very, very few mainstream media organizations on the continent, whether state or perhaps private, would necessarily have covered this. So your guess is as well as mine. How are these things and these matters going to reach the conversational tables of average African citizenry?
Despite the return of the looted artifacts being a drop in the ocean, the people of Benin are jubilant and hopeful that this will be the start of full restitution.
Today we're so happy about what's happening in our country. We're so happy. What we've been looking for, it's for our artwork to come back to us.
Finally, we ask Mr. Ocheno, what is the significance of the restitution of stolen artifacts to the African people?
Really, so that we can begin to have the conversations to heal the past and begin to move forward. And there is no other better way of healing the past than merely returning what is purely African. Because one of the things, and a good case would be made, both politically and legally, that not only is it the return of these items good enough, but imagine you borrowing, getting a loan, even if it's only 1% per annum, and is for over 130 or 150 years, how much would it be? So no, I think it's in the best interest of Western governments and these institutions to return our stuff under whatever circumstances. But going forward, I hope Africans will join part of this conversation and debate and demand for the return of these items, all of it really, but also make sure that in the event that there is a difficulty in returning, we make it as much a political case and a political question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Ocheno. There you have it. He says African people must insist on the return of all artifacts looted by Western countries during the era of colonialism. On that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, recently in the news, we have read that the Palestinian families are facing the threat of forced eviction from their homes in East Al-Quds, neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. You know, and they have rejected an Israeli court so-called conflict resolution proposal that would be enable Israeli settlers to eventually confiscate their land in 15 years. And this is the news. A really nice achievement for the families of Sheikh Jarrah, who rejected the compromise offered to them by the court of the occupation and the Israeli. So with the Sayyid Murtaza, first of all, give us the story. What's the story exactly? What's the story of the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah?
Well, actually, no, it's a part of the Palestinian history.
Mm-hmm.
And many parts of the East Jerusalem, unfortunately, have been taken by these occupiers.
Yes.
Specifically talking these Jews who are following the political philosophy of Zionism.
Yes.
And this was actually the main reason.
Yes.
That now we have Palestinian resistance
yes.
to any forced displacement.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, over the past 40, 60 years, thousands, or better to say, millions of Palestinians have been displaced, not only internally, but externally.
That's right. We have
IDPs, I mean, internal displaced people inside the occupied land, the Palestine. And we have many Palestinians have been expelled. And they have been forced to leave the Palestine forever.
Yes.
So this shows that the history has been unfortunately very tough and difficult on Palestinians.
Yes.
And actually this forced displacement is something that they are inheriting from past.
Okay.
I mean, it was not their own choice. It was not made arbitrarily. It was something that was brought upon them by outsiders.
Yes.
So now this neighborhood and other areas that are facing some kind of forced eviction or displacement is the same thing that happened around 40, 60 years ago.
Yes.
So the history is full of this kind of evictions.
That's right.
And now, because we have medias, and because these people who are facing such a forced displacement have the opportunity to use the medias, and they actually raise their voice
right.
to the whole world that what is happening in that area is not fair and is not even good according to the international standards. And we know international standards are not fair.
That's right.
So equality has been gone.
That's right.
So this neighborhood has a very rich history.
Mm-hmm. You mean look Sheikh Jarrah?
Yeah, look at the name
okay,
of sure. this neighborhood.
Yes, yes.
Sheikh Jarrah, he was a very influential figure
yes.
in that area.
Yes.
And even this neighborhood comes after him.
Yes.
So if this settling commissioner, I can say, comes to believe that they are able to evacuate this neighborhood from the influential factors, other settlers in the same neighborhood will actually leave, and they will be, evacuated by any means.
That's right.
So, unfortunately, we have four or five, neighbors now that they are just involved in fighting back such an unfair decision that was made by a Zionist, I think, court.
That's right.
So the background, the historical background of this neighborhood or this place is very much known to the local Palestinians, and now it has been internationally known to the whole world.
That's all right, and we know that, this Sheikh Jarrah protest, coincided with the decision to ban gathering in the Muslim in the holy month of Ramadan. As could you remember, they have attacked the Damascus gate of the holy city of Al-Quds, and the riots are over there. 260 Palestinians were killed, 66 children among them.
Yeah.
And this was the most sad news. Again, we could see this international silence in the media on this side. But still, the four Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah have requested, the world in order to see what's happening over there, because the east of Al-Quds is being evacuated wholly from the families over there. So, Said Mohsen, what's your take on that, brother, and this story?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there is a clear statement in the Quran in chapter Nisa, verse number 148.
Mm-hmm.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لا يحب الله الجهر بسوء من القول إلا من ظلم. Allah does not like someone to declare or openly talk about the evil if someone has done evil to someone or a wrong thing to someone, except if it was an oppression or ظلم. So if there is some injustice, if there is an oppression, then obviously you must, speak out, you must protest, and you must talk about it, inform others. This is the rule set by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran. وَكَانَ اللَّهُ سَمِيعًا عَلِيمًا. So, and Allah is the all-hearing and all-knowing. What these four families are doing, it's really courageable, and we must congratulate them on their courage that they have. And obviously, we know that they're living there for many years, and it's from their forefathers, from when they're living. And just because being at the neighbor, like the settlers that at the neighbor of that area, like which is for the Zionist regime, if they want to evacuate it,
and they want to turn it into a public park.
Yeah.
This is the news. Okay.
So basically, it's not. It's again, it's against the human rights.
Mm-hmm.
You have some human beings living there. Which are there for many years, and even their forefathers were there, and now you're coming and you want to evacuate them.
Yes.
For your own, we can say,
especially political
for ease
pleasure.
Or
okay.
The political pleasure.
Yes.
Or entertainment, what you have. So what these families are doing, it's really, it's a good thing, it's a good step which they have taken. And if they evacuate that place, then obviously the rest of the people will also evacuate. Obviously, it will be very easy for the Zionist regime to evacuate anyone. But if they have resistance, if the Zionist regime face resistance from these four families, then obviously it will be something hard for them to evacuate the rest of places. And obviously, it's our duty, everyone's duty, to show our sympathy with these four families.
That's right.
Which are also, according to some writings I was reading, that they belong, they are the families of Sheikh Jarrah.
Yes.
They are the relatives of
yes.
Sheikh Jarrah. And Sheikh Jarrah was someone who has a value or a noble person
yes.
in his
area. During
he was an
and that's right,
active
that's right.
person,
yes,
yes, in his area. So why the pressure is only on these four families and not the rest? This is another question. And
yes.
the same thing which you mentioned, like in the month of Ramadan,
yes.
the way they had the massive killing
yeah,
of
man.
These Muslims,
yes.
That was unfortunately
the
something.
66 children have been killed
yeah.
in those attacks, 11-day attacks on the coastal region of the Palestine at that time.
And I don't know why the human rights is silent now. Where does the UNO goes?
Yeah.
Where this UNICEF, what this UNICEF is doing
because
right
Israel
now.
Is not a legitimate land. What has to do with the UN, you know, because it's not a part of the UN even.
These countries can basically decide something about this oppression or these regime that are basically occupying, and they're obviously expanding or doing oppression over these people. Yes. So at least they should speak out. They should take a stand against what they're doing. And I think this is the time when the world needs to show themselves that on the basis of human rights, at least, they should save these four families. They should save these places. And let's not allow Israeli do whatever they want.
Yes.
And this is the time that the whole Muslim Ummah should, stand against it and spread this news amongst the people so people get awareness.
Yes.
And the way we can see, like I was just looking at yesterday's news that there was a football match behind which people were flying the flags of Palestine.
Yeah, in Spain.
In Spain,
yes.
So alhamdulillah, we can see that there are some people who are basically spreading the word, and people are getting know.
Yes.
So we need such kind of movement
to
stop this Zionist regime from whatever they want to, like stopping them from doing what they want to do.
You know, Mona Al-Kord, you know, one of the Sheikh Jarrah's resistance, has said that the Israeli judiciary is circumventing its obligation to issue a final decision and is making us choose between dispossession of our lands and submitting to an unjust agreement. We won't allow Israel to make itself as a just occupation at our expense. This is what Mona Al-Kord has said, you know, to the media. And that's it, choosing between dispossession, I mean leaving your land, and also submitting to an unjust agreement. They have put this family between the two. Okay, Sir Mursa, any remarks?
Well, you know, a freedom fighter, or I can call it Mujahid, will never actually surrender his own freedom to tyranny, to unjust government, or any ruling power.
Yes.
So what these four families have been doing for a while is very much expected from a freedom fighter.
Yes.
So, and you know, most of these Palestinians living under, tough, very harsh condition, are fighting back the Zionist regime, as many military officials said, is enjoying one of the greatest, military equipments and military means.
Yes.
So this shows that maybe you are able to fight back, bare hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these four families have actually presented this ideology that surrendering to an unjust government is not what can actually solve your problem.
It's
going to make your problem bigger and larger and more difficult to manage.
Yes.
So these four families so far have proved that they are believing in a very strong ideology that freedom will come upon you if you just wait and keep fighting back.
That's all right. This is good news, and may Allah help them, inshallah, to have their own lands and possess it again, and not evacuate that region, because I think this is a piece of a big puzzle, you know, of the Zionist power in that region, East Al-Quds, to occupy the whole land over there, the public park, you know, man. All we know that this is a political game, you know, and just the surface of the matter.
You know, even the statement that the judicials have, the statement that either you leave immediately or you can settle for, you know, 15 years.
Yes.
This shows us that it is their own place.
Mm-hmm.
They were living there. They own that place.
Yes.
And the Zionist regime has no right to throw them out of that place.
Yes.
Why they're giving them, if they have occupied that land and it's related to the Zionist regime, that obviously they shouldn't allow them to live for even a single day. Why they're giving them these 15 years to settle for 15 years, and then you need to leave the
place. I believe no part of the Palestine belongs to Israel.
Obviously, we know that.
Okay.
This is clear.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, within the statements, the things are clear.
Yes.
These statements shows us. So therefore, the world should stand against what the Zionist regime are doing and give the right to these four families what they have. And similarly, it will give courage to the rest of the settlers who are around this area, inshallah. And the victory is with the Palestinian nations, not anyone else.
So there are so many lessons also in the behavior of these four families in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. for some of the so-called Muslim lands that have been the base for the Western powers, you know, inside the countries. You know, we have to learn many lessons from the behaviors of this family over there in Sheikh Jarrah. And I hope that one day it will be free and Palestine will be free, inshallah. Thank you, my Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen.
You're welcome.
For your presence in the program Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this program and also to download for free our previous episodes of this program, refer to our website, parstoday.com/ENT. Another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, oh, it's taking my breath away. So blessed out here today.
A Leech in Paradise, Part 1.
Playing golf is important for bankers. It's a good place to talk to clients because no one is going to listen to you on the golf course. The high net worth individuals, you would meet them in the office. I worked in 8 secrecy jurisdictions, Cayman Islands, BVIs, Bermuda, Guernsey, Jersey, Isle of Man, Mauritius, all of them had golf courses. When I was in the Caymans, I had the option to play golf and to learn golf and to entertain clients, and that was great. I mean, but, you know, basically I do think it's a boring sport because you put the ball on the ground, hit it once and another movement, it's kind of boring. I rather prefer soccer where you've got more action, you've got the team play, you've got...
Rudolf Elmer worked for 15 years for Bank Julius Baer, one of Switzerland's largest private banks. He started out as basic auditor in Zurich and ended up deputy CEO of the bank's Cayman Islands branch. It was there, in the Caribbean, that his life changed dramatically at the start of the 2000s. A murky tale of unpaid medical expenses, an overly critical mind, all played out in an atmosphere of professional rivalry with his superior. In 2003, Bank Julius Baer fired Rudolf Elmer in circumstances that were, to say the least, troubling. Security breaches had been uncovered at the Grand Cayman branch, and 6 executives, including Elmer, were asked to undergo a rather unusual test. Since this clash, Rudolf Elmer's life has become a never-ending fight. First against Bank Julius Baer, but also against international tax evasion, and then against the judicial system of his home country, Switzerland. Rudolf Elmer carried on his fight in the shadows while continuing his career in the banking world. He worked in Mauritius for the offshore branch of Africa's largest bank.
I worked for Standard Bank as a head of fiduciary services, and my project was to outsource trusts and companies from Isle of Man to Mauritius, and I was on a 2-year contract. I was pretty successful because staff and even management nominated me to the superstar of Standard Bank. All right, I didn't make it, but I was nominated. So everything looked fine, and we were in discussion to go on with my contract. And then there was that day when I was asked by management to come down, in the office, and then I was told I don't need to come to the office tomorrow. They have received some information, and they have to sort it out first, and I don't need to come to the office. And I didn't know what was going on, but in the background, or the information I received, is information out of Julius Baer.
Elmer's a very conservative man. He comes from a very, very poor working class background, and he's made it into the heart of the Swiss establishment, into the financial sector. And he is, or was for years, extremely loyal to the financial sector, unusually loyal, because he has made it out of nowhere to be a somebody. And therefore, I think it was a real shock to him when the system started to let him down, when it behaved badly. And then when he complained about that bad behavior, when it ejected him. So I think he was completely unprepared to play this role of whistleblower. And it's taken him literally years to work out how to do it. And it's really only recently that he's understood how to do it by coming out publicly and trying to build alliances who can help him to get the truth out.
A few weeks before being fired from Standard Bank, Rudolf Elmer went through the looking glass, so to speak. After 5 years of ambivalence, he finally opted to openly become a whistleblower. He started by sending hundreds of confidential documents from Bank Julius Baer to a then virtually unknown website. The leak started on January the 9th, 2008, with over 200 pages of documents related to the former leader of Hong Kong, Tung Chi Hwa. I discovered the flagship product sold by the bank to its ultra-rich clients, Cayman Islands Trusts. A trust is a private contract in which the client hands over his or her fortune to a trustee in order to become non-taxable. But in most cases, clients continue to manage their assets covertly with the help of the bank. The trust is therefore a smokescreen to facilitate tax fraud. The Dragon Trust, created by Tung Chi Hwa, held nearly $20 million in accounts in Zurich, London, and Hong Kong. A few days later, WikiLeaks published the banking files of five other clients, including a Greek shipping magnate, Anna Kanalakis. Her trust owns a fleet of tankers and a bank account in Zurich worth $30 million. The bank was quick to react to these leaks, which were growing day by day.
Bank Julius Baer hired lawyers in LA. And the lawyers in LA represent the Hollywood stars. They're very, very aggressive at trying to basically use abusive process to shut down publications. Their tactic was to spray out subpoenas, spray out legal demands, and move extremely quickly. So they had a court case without even us turning up, and a temporary restraining order was issued, which knocked off the WikiLeaks domain name for about 10 days. Now, that was great for us. The New York Times read editorials on it. Our IP address was published around the world. We managed to build up a coalition of 22 different lawyers and came back in about 10 days' time with this very significant coalition. And there was extremely substantial media exposure. Each one of these lawyers or legal groups in the coalition, of course, put out press releases. We put out our own press release. And so we made Bank Julius Baer bleed, really bleed, from the negative publicity associated with that. And as a result, they had to cancel their US IPO, their initial public offering on the stock market of the US registration of Bank Julius Baer, which cost them hundreds of millions. And so they pulled out of the case.
Galvanized by this victory, WikiLeaks resumed publication of the Julius Baer files. Some clearly stated that the bank accepts undeclared funds. Other documents raised more questions. Why did the daughter of British sculptor Henry Moore set up the Spencer Trust to transfer works of art from Liechtenstein and Panama to the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands? Then, there was the Moonstone Trust, set up for the wealthy German industrialist Robert Schuller. His home was searched on Christmas Eve 2009 as a consequence of the documents leaked by Rudolf Elmer to WikiLeaks. To protect his anonymity, the businessman was helped by a Zurich lawyer, Pietro Supino. This frontman would later become chairman of Tamedia, one of the biggest media groups in Switzerland. Rudolf Elmer also caused tax problems for Belgian businessman Philipp Stockle, whose documents show even to the eyes of Julius Baer that the trust was fictional. Ironically, Philipp Stockle had been lobbying Belgian authorities for years to obtain public subsidies to restore the famous Stockle Palace built in Brussels for his grandfather. These leaks spanned 14 months. They were the first ever important leaks of banking data via the internet. The lengthy investigation of British journalist Nick Davies, published in The Guardian, gave Rudolf Elmer international recognition.
Elmer's data is extremely interesting because it's very unusual for us to be able to see the detail of what goes on, A, inside a Swiss bank, which is a highly secretive organization, and B, inside a tax haven like the Caymans, which also is protected by specific secrecy law. And what Elmer gives us is hundreds and hundreds of pages of internal paperwork, which provides really close-up detail on the way that the bank operates and on the way that the tax haven operates.
As a grand finale, Elmer leaked the files of two big fish. The candidate for the presidency of Brazil in 2002, Rosana Sani, appeared as a beneficiary of the Coronado Trust based in Guernsey. She was forced to step down from the presidential race after police raided her company and found unexplained cash. Rudolf Elmer also leaked the bank files of a Mexican general who was convicted but then acquitted for colluding with drug traffickers. Arturo Acosta Chaparro was also accused of being responsible for more than 100 disappearances during Mexico's dirty war in the 1970s. His trust, managed by Julius Baer, held $3 million. Releasing such sensitive information into the public domain in a world where secrecy is the rule can change a person's life, especially when it's not done anonymously.
I don't want to patronize him, but I think I began to feel sorry for him. He has lost his career, and he's lost his peace of mind. I don't mean to say that he's mad, I just mean to say that he has a lot to worry about now. He has lost his income, and he's suffered from being isolated. And yet he does have something important to say.
To get his message out, Elmer wrote a book about his experience in tax havens. Meanwhile, he tried to earn a living by importing Indian beer onto the island. But he quickly ran out of money. Elmer's wife and daughter returned to Zurich.
Rudy's business hasn't started up so well, and he's still struggling with it. So this is why I'm here, to earn some money for the family. I live with my mother-in-law, and we share a flat, basically. My social life is very limited. I work long hours, and I go back home late. I'm keeping my costs low and trying not to spend extraordinary amounts of money. What I earn here, about half of it goes back to Mauritius to support Rudy there. At the moment, I'm trying to find a flat for us to bring him back here. I'm now trying to solve a problem, basically, and keeping the family together in any way I can. It's not that I chose to do this. I'm just kind of putting back together broken glass.
Alone in Mauritius with no prospects, Rudolf Elmer was a little unsettled, The situation was beyond him. Persona non grata in the banking world, Elmer decided to go back to Switzerland to confront his demons. But he first stopped off in London to get advice and support.
There were drastic consequences on both sides, on personal and then the professional life. A lot of friends stopped talking to us. We lost contact. I lost my job 3 times. The first time was in the Cayman Islands because I couldn't complete a lie detector test due to my physical problems. The second time it was with Noble Group when police in Zurich started the investigation. They put me to prison. They said they couldn't trust me anymore. So after that, we left for Mauritius, worked there for 2 years. And then the Standard Bank decided to stop my contract because of the blackmailing of Julius Baer. It's hard, and you are pushed to kind of to become an outlaw. In that sense, if you're a whistleblower, they treat you as a criminal, even so you come up with information which actually is going how to get the criminals, which is weird, but that's the reality.
Rudolf Elmer met with U.S. legal counsel for the first time. Jack A. Blum was already defending the interests of Heinrich Kieber, a whistleblower who'd caused a banking scandal in Liechtenstein.
Things I want to talk to you about, some of which I can talk to you about by the microphone on, and some will.
Yeah, all right, Dan.
The government of Liechtenstein says Kieber is a criminal. The government of Switzerland has tried to say Elmer is a criminal. The truth is, those governments are criminals. The people in their banks are criminals. They are aggressively promoting crime in other countries. Elmer has very serious difficulties. You know, we think of people who are refugees because of war or other problems. He's a refugee because of his attitude toward what he saw inside the banking system. And he should be at least entitled to the same kind of status as other refugees. There is an industry in the offshore world which is set up and makes its money by helping people in major countries cheat on their taxes. Now, the implications of that for the rest of us are extraordinary. We pay taxes. We are now confronting massive national deficits everywhere. We are being told that basic services will have to be cut because there's no money to pay for them. And here are the richest, most successful people in our societies who are saying, well, let them pay for it, not me. And that is an unacceptable proposition.
1 hour after this interview, the UK tax authorities were given a CD full of offshore banking data from the Standard Bank. Rudolf Elmer never knew if the data was used by tax authorities. Tax secrecy is just as untransparent as the sacrosanct banking secrecy.
There are very powerful organisations, by which I mean the majority of Swiss banks and British banks, that need to reassure their clients, that is tax-evading clients and criminal clients from across the world, that their personal affairs are absolutely secure and hidden behind banking secrecy legislation, not just banking secrecy legislation, but secrecy arrangements of tax havens in the Caribbean, which use trusts and offshore companies. Their most profitable activities depend upon their clients feeling that their affairs are totally secret. And any indication that that secrecy is being blown by whistleblowers, or by leaks, or by steps to degrade banking secrecy at an international level, will undermine their clients' confidence in their ability to secure secrecy. That's what's happening. In other words, an entire industry based upon secrecy is under threat, and these people are responding the only way they know how, which is to attack the people who are trying to degrade that secrecy. I've seen enough of the information he has, and I've spoken enough with Rudy over several years to feel this man does know what he's talking about. He's under great pressure personally, he is stressed, but he knows what he's talking about. The attacks on him are intended to undermine the integrity of what he's doing and to distract attention from the fact that he is challenging a system which is very deeply rooted and extremely aggressive at protecting itself. Most of the Swiss press that I saw reacted by, in English terms, going for the man, not the ball. In other words, if this was a football game, they fouled. They went for Rudy. They didn't look at the bank. And the bank put out press releases saying, look, here we have a rogue individual, heavily stressed, apparently psychologically deranged. So that distracted attention entirely from the issues that he was trying to raise. Now, we've seen this in many whistleblowing cases. This is how the public relations counter-attack happens. You don't draw attention to the issues or the data. You draw attention to the fact this individual has a chip on his shoulder. You know, he's psychologically deranged.
Ask the followers of remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question that sometimes people ask. And that question is with respect to the manner in which the infallible human beings, such as the Imams, alayhim as-salam, the Prophets, alayhim as-salam, are examples and parables for us. To be specific, some people ask, most of these infallible people are men. And at the same time, we have been asked to, all of us have been asked to take them as examples for ourselves. At the same time, we know that in Islam, there are certain responsibilities which are specific to genders. For example, it's true that there are certain responsibilities which are common to both genders, to men and women. However, the manner in which these common responsibilities are to be carried out are different. For example, the prayer is something which is a common responsibility. It's a responsibility that's shared by both men and women. Both men should pray and women should pray. Nevertheless, the way that women pray should be different, is different from the way that men should pray. The same thing goes with other responsibilities.